It is always fun to be a gardener, but I think for many of us, maybe for you, you kind of get downright giddy when the first signs of spring come along. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. We appreciate all our Garden Talk guests. But the breadth and depth of knowledge that our UW Extension guests have is absolutely amazing to me. And one of those guests is Patty Nagai, UW Extension horticulture educator. She works for Racine County and has a wealth of information to share. Always happy when she can join us on Garden Talk. And once again, Patty, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, you know, I'm always happy to be here and happy to share whatever I can.
Well, it's
I don't know it all, but I... I can sometimes work it out. So,
well, I'll tell you what, it's really fun. I got a note from someone who said that mother's crocuses are already up.
Oh, that's amazing. And the snow has melted in parts of my yard, and I see things starting to pop up, but I don't have any flowers yet. I have a lot of early spring flowering bulbs that are... that I've put in over the years. Last year I put in probably almost 1,000 bulbs.
Wow.
And a lot of them were the minor bulbs that are supposed to come up and flower really early. And I was very distressed because I had so much snow in my yard and it was so cold. And I thought for sure that underneath all that snow, things were happening that I just couldn't see. But now that the snow has melted, I realize that I haven't missed anything yet. They are just starting to come up. But, you know, with a few warm days and some sunshine, those early spring flowering bulbs, shrubs, things, they will move along really quickly.
Really fast, yeah.
So it's a great idea, especially on a day like today. I know here in Madison and in the southeast, it's a gorgeous blue sky, sunny day. It's really a good time to just... take a little survey of your yard and your gardens mm-hmm. and see what you can see. It's a little too early for a lot of things to tell how much damage has been done. And some things are very, very late to bud out anyway. And so that's a good idea to know those things as well. You know, which of the plants in your yard are very slow to come back. So don't make fast assumptions that just because you don't mm-hmm. see growth now or even next month that they're dead. But, of course, in some cases, we may have things that
truly...
cases,
they probably
are. They may be dead, but there are ways to tell.
You know, I walked out of my own backyard this morning. The sun had pretty well eliminated all of the snow off my backyard, which mm-hmm. is really wide open. And so, but, I, you know, when I walk down the lawn, it's still frozen.
Right.
So...
Right. And that's an important thing to keep in mind as well, because our... our soil temperatures are going to be very low, even if you do detect a little bit of thawing. But in most places, the ground, it's been insulated with all of that snow. You know, and it's not that we had a huge amount of snow, mm-hmm. but we've had pretty straight snow cover for some time now.
Yeah.
And incredibly cold temperatures in many parts of the state. And so the soil is going to be frozen.
Yeah.
It will take more than just a day or two of sunshine to warm up that huge mass of soil.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Well, we have lots of callers online. I want to go to a Facebook photo first. And by the way, if you have a photo you want to put up on our Facebook page or a question on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show. And you can post a photo or a question or comment there. We've got some already, including one from Cheryl that is a photo that I have never seen a plant like this. It's just coming up now at her husband's place of business. And Cheryl, if you're listening, why don't you let us know where that place of business is? You know, it looks kind of like a grass, but it's pink to my eye.
It is pink. And, you know, based on the cut foliage stems that are on the ground, it does look like it is an ornamental grass. But it is a beautiful pink color. And I'm just not sure what that is. For it to come up so early, it must, well, depending on where this picture was taken.
Right,
that
yeah.
could change things. But, it could be a cool season grass or definitely an early arriver for spring. But I'm not sure what it is. So anybody out there who can look at that picture on Facebook and give us some clues, it's...
Yeah, it'd be nice to hear.
I think I would like it in my yard.
It's pretty nice looking.
You know, this time of year, I am always looking for things to brighten up my yard early in spring that give me some tangible evidence that spring is really here, which is one of the reasons that I planted all of those bulbs. I planted winter aconite and a lot of different types of crocus and the dwarf iris that bloom really early. Because I appreciate so much those little signs of color early in spring.
Yeah. Hans sent us a note on Facebook. It was his mother, by the way, who saw the crocuses already. Wondering about pre-emergence timing. I used to plan for crabgrass control. However, the emergence thing hasn't been updated since 2014. Am I just too early?
It is too early to be putting anything down for crabgrass pre-emergent or fertilizer. You know, the ground is still frozen.
Right.
It's not a good idea to be putting things like that on the grass right now. Crabgrass pre-emergent is an interesting product because products, because there are so many of them, and they have very different methods that they work, different temperatures that they're activated, and different length of time that they are actually active in the soil. So if you're using an organic product, you know, one of the products that contains corn gluten meal, those are very short-lived crabgrass pre-emergence, and they need to be applied, you know, right about the time that the crabgrass would be coming up, which is in that 50 to 55 degree soil temperature range. So that's That's kind of your most accurate indicator of when crabgrass seeds would be germinating, is in that temperature range of the soil, not the air, the soil. Our phenological indicator for that it's pretty accurate, is when the common forsythia blooms.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to correlate with a soil temperature of about 50 degrees.
About 50.
So that's a good phenological indicator to look for putting down crabgrass pre-emergent. But there are a lot of different chemistries available for crabgrass pre-emergence. And so if you're applying it yourself, you definitely need to read the label very carefully before you purchase the product, and again before you apply it. Some of the pre-emergence last for a few weeks, maybe 4 to 6 weeks. Some of them last 4 to 6 months.
Yeah.
So if part of your overall lawn care plan is to do overseeding or some repair seeding in your yard, and you've put down a crabgrass pre-emergent that lasts 4 to 6 months,
that's not good.
Your grass seed will not germinate either. So you need to be very careful about that. The organic products that contain corn gluten meal are a little more lenient in that, because they're so short-lived in their activity. And, you know, they can work really well if they're applied and the temperature stays great and the moisture content is perfect. But it is an organic, natural product, and so it doesn't always work.
Yeah. Mike in Madison has a question for us. Let's go to Mike. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good afternoon. My question is relating to blueberries and honeyberries. And with the blueberries, the previous owners of my house had taken these blue spruce trees that I have in the yard and butchered them up about 6 feet off the ground. But I know blueberries like an acidic soil, and I'm wondering if that might be a good spot to plant blueberries around underneath the blue spruce, since it's already acidic soil. It's been pruned up for quite a few years, so the soil isn't all pine needles, which I think might be great for blueberries. And then the second question on that is honeyberries. I don't know if you're familiar with honeyberries. It's kind of like a blueberry plant, but I don't know too many people. I've asked a bunch of questions in the local greenhouses and so forth, and not too many people know much about the honeyberries, but I'd like to grow them.
Sounds like a common name.
Or a cultivar. Well, I'm not sure. I'm not familiar with honeyberries either, so I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. It might be something, you know, that we could look up, but it's not a common fruit crop that I'm familiar with that grows in Wisconsin.
No, it's a newer one they're introducing.
So is it a cultivar? Is it a cultivar of blueberry?
From my understanding, it's not. It's its own.
It's an own thing
from the blueberry. Yeah,
okay.
But it looks just like a. It's taller than a blueberry plant. It has a different leaf structure, but it produces fruit that's very similar to a blueberry.
Do you know if it's in the same family with blueberries?
That I don't know, because the seed catalogs don't give its genus name.
Oh, well, that's tricky. Well, let's go on the assumption that it is a type of blueberry. And there are a lot of different types of blueberries in addition to the cultivars. But blueberries, much like cranberries, require a very acidic soil, which you apparently know. However, to be sure of your soil acidity, you really do need to do a soil test, because blueberry production will not be successful unless your pH is very low. And they prefer a pH, 4.5 to 5.2-ish, somewhere in that range, which is very acidic. Neutral is pH 7. In my part of Wisconsin, in the southeast region, the soil pHs run anywhere from 6.2 to 8, which is more on the alkaline side. So we can't grow blueberries successfully there, even with huge amounts of soil modification, unless somebody just happens to have a little pocket of soil where the pH is low. Blueberries just don't grow in our part of Wisconsin. But I'm not sure in Madison, what the range of soil pHs are, but before you invest in any kind of blueberry production, it would really behoove you to do some soil testing to see where your pH lies. In addition, planting things underneath any kind of tree, even though it's been limbed up, is not always a great idea, because you're going to have a lot of tree roots there that are going to compete for nutrients, water, and you still have the shade issue to deal with. And fruit crops like blueberry require a very, very large amount of sunlight. So you need full sun, you need well-drained organic soil that is in a much lower pH range of, even down to 4.2, blueberries will grow quite well in that area of pH. But a lot of our soil doesn't meet that kind of that range of pH where blueberries will grow successfully. Alternatively, I know a lot of people who will choose to grow blueberries in either raised beds or containers and just know that it's going to be a short-lived crop for them.
Yeah.
So with the honeyberries, I'm not sure, because I'm not sure exactly what it is. Looks like Larry may have looked something
up.
Yeah,
I looked it up. It's a member of the honeysuckle family.
Oh, it's a Lonicera.
Yes, it is.
Oh, well, that's completely different.
Yeah.
So honeysuckle, Lonicera generally will grow in our soil in a pretty wide range of soil types. So that's interesting.
They're native to eastern Russia and hardy to minus 40.
It's not one of the Loniceras that's on the invasive plant species list, is it, Larry?
I don't know. I'm gonna hand over my cell phones.
Lonicera caerulea in the honeysuckle family. Honeyberry bushes are widely adapted, few pests, easy to grow. They produce small, elongated blue fruits that taste like blueberries. Oh, interesting. And they are hardy to zone 3. So that's interesting. The only thing that I would be cautious about, because of the other issues that we have with some of the bush honeysuckles, is whether or not they're on the invasive species list.
Yeah, that's...
And they may
need
be.
To check that.
Yes.
We need to check that for sure.
So it's an interesting quandary, because, of course, a beautiful fruit-producing plant that we like, that might be really attractive, that produces a lot of fruit... Mm-hmm. Might also be very attractive to birds, mm-hmm. who would then eat the fruit and spread those seed into our native areas.
Yeah, something to worry about.
So that would be my one caution with that. I'm sure it will grow here.
Yeah.
And I've eaten honeysuckle fruit. I know that they taste pretty good, and so
all right.
The birds like them as well.
Patty Nagai, our guest. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lenz, our on-air producer today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on next week's Garden Talk show, Judith will be filling in, visiting with Leslie Bennett, author of The Beautiful Edible Garden. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. And for all of the counties today, because she's on Garden Talk, and it's always great to have her with us. We had an email from Pete in Appleton who wondered about apple trees. He said he wasn't expecting the warmer weather to come so soon, waited a little long to prune the trees. Is it too late to prune his apple trees? If he prunes now, will it stimulate growth too early? What should he do?
This is actually the perfect time to be pruning apple trees and crab apple trees. And, you know, a crab apple is simply an apple tree that is makes really tiny fruit.
Yeah.
So, we grow crab apples, of course, for different reasons. But the pruning methods for the two of them are really pretty similar. Because what we want from both of them is a tree that produces a lot of flowers and potentially a lot of fruit, because those are the ornamental characteristics that we desire in the crabapple tree. And, of course, in the eating apple tree, we want fruit production that will be very hardy and stay on the tree until they're ready to pick in the fall. And so the pruning methods are really similar, and both of them require annual pruning in order to be productive and healthy. This is not a bad time to prune. In fact, that period between February, March, and even into early April is the perfect time to prune most fruit trees. And a lot of it depends on your individual climate, your individual weather. The things that we try to avoid are not pruning too early in winter when the temperatures are super cold, because the trees are not able to seal over those wounds. And with really big cuts, you can actually kill your fruit trees if you prune too much in really severe cold weather. So you want to avoid super cold weather. You want to avoid days where it is wet. So ideally, you would like a warm, dry day to do your pruning to make sure that you're not spreading fungal diseases and opening up too many wounds in that really moist environment. So warm and dry day. It looks like the next few days might be actually perfect for pruning in a number of areas around Wisconsin. So you make your cuts. We have lots of great publications on the Learning Store, learningstore.uwx.edu, on how to prune apple trees if you're not familiar with how to make the cuts and what to look for.
Take a look.
So look at that and make good, clean cuts. Keep your pruning tools clean and disinfested with either a spray-type disinfectant, or some people still are using a bleach solution, which works, but, you know, it can rust out your pruning tools. So keep your tools clean. Pick a nice, warm, dry day. Make good, clean cuts. Don't leave stubs, and you should be fine.
Mark in Door County has a question. Let's go there. Mark, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Looking for a vine or some kind of climbing plant that I can put in front of a electrical meter on a new construction for a cottage up in Door County.
Okay.
And it gets sun maybe 3 or 4 hours in the morning, at least direct sun, but that's pretty much all the sun's going to get during the day. And I'm a little impatient, so I'm hoping to get something that will grow relatively fast.
Do you have a trellis for it to grow on?
Yeah, we do. We have a trellis about 7 feet high and about 3 feet wide.
Okay. And it gets a good 3 hours of direct sun in the morning, but is it in full shade the rest of the day or part shade?
Probably part shade.
Well, there are a number of vines that are pretty fast growing that you could put there. There are, most of them will produce flowers and beautiful foliage colors if they are more in full sun. But, you know, it might be enough. Are you interested in more of a perennial vine or an annual vine?
Well, I prefer not to have to replant it every year.
So okay.
Okay. So the things that you might want to look at are Sweet Autumn Clematis, which is a very rapidly growing perennial vine. It's pretty tough. It's pretty hardy. It will flower better in full sun conditions, but I think even with the amount of light that you have there, it probably will flower very nicely for you in that area. I have one in my yard that gets morning sun and then dappled shade in the afternoon. It grew, the first year I put it in, it grew a good 6 feet. And covered a trellis that was like 3 feet wide and was completely covered in flowers in the fall. It was very pretty, so it did well. So that's a possibility. There are some native type vines There's Virginia creeper, of course, that is the native vine that grows in the woods that looks a little bit like poison ivy. that one would grow in full shade. But it's not, you know, there are some cultivars of Virginia creeper that have really pretty fall color, but their flowers are not showy at all. But it would cover, and it would cover very quickly. But I would recommend using a cultivar of Virginia creeper as opposed to the native species, because the native species would probably grow beyond the bounds of your trellis. So those are two possibilities that I think would work really well.
I like the first best.
The sweet autumn clematis. It's a really pretty one.
Really pretty. Yeah.
Is there anything that we could do with that in the meantime? Is that a type of plant that we could begin inside and then transfer, or is that one we should just wait for soil to warm up and plant it outside and let it do its job out there?
You can plant it as soon as you can purchase one from the local garden center and get it in the ground. You can also order it online. Mm-hmm. As soon as the ground is not frozen, and, you know, those plants generally can go outside, especially if they've come from a northern nursery, you know, a local nursery, preferably where they're outside already in their containers. Usually perennials and perennial vines and shrubs, you know, in southeast Wisconsin, we generally can get those in the ground in April. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, the nice thing about perennials is that you can plant them all the way up until the ground freezes in fall. And so as soon as you can get in the ground in the spring, all the way through summer and into fall, you can plant perennials.
There you go. Good luck, Mark. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. John in Oshkosh has a question. Hi, John.
Hi. Am I on?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes.
Okay. I've always had some difficulty understanding the definition of native plants, because obviously every plant that we have here in Wisconsin came from somewhere. So my question is, was there some kind of survey that was done cataloging all the native plants, and everything else becomes an invasive species? Go on.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, not everything that is non-native is invasive. And so that is, you know, it's interesting. These terms get used in a lot of different ways, and I can understand your confusion and your concern for what you're hearing. Mm-hmm. So a native species is a species that was essentially here and well established when we came here, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
So, and yes, there are catalogs. A lot of the native species that we have on our lists are things that we know were well established either in the woodland areas, in that region between woodland and prairie, and then, of course, in the prairies themselves. And so those species are very well established, and there are native species and ecotypes that are known and propagated for different regions in Wisconsin. So it's not just for a true native plant gardener. It's not enough to even say that you have the native species for Wisconsin. You need to have the native species for a very specific range of land in Wisconsin. And so it can get very complicated when trying to define those species. Mm-hmm. We also have what are called cultivars of native species. And sometimes those are bred cultivars. Sometimes they are selected cultivars, which means that in our natural environment, plants have done their usual thing, because plants breed with each other quite readily if they have, you know, similar genetics. They breed together all the time. And so we have natural selection, and we have natural genetic diversity that occurs. And so sometimes we have selected varieties of native species. Sometimes we have bred varieties of native species. And so those sometimes get labeled as native plants, but for a lot of people, they would not consider a selected cultivar or a bred cultivar as a true native species. Invasive species are a completely different thing, because we can have a native plant. And the example that I like to use is wild grape. Mm-hmm. Wild grape is a native plant. It's been in Wisconsin forever. It is horribly invasive. And in some areas, if not controlled, it can kill other plants, other trees. It's just, it can be very problematic. And because it produces a fruit that's attracted to birds, it gets spread. And
all over the place.
It could take over. And so that's a native species that can be invasive. But we also have a lot of introduced plants that were introduced for all sorts of reasons. Ornamental, ground cover, erosion control, novelty, food crops, lots of things that are introduced non-native species that are not invasive at all and not a problem in our environment.
So there you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Somewhat related is a comment on our Facebook page from Christine that has to do with sweet autumn clematis. I heard recently that sweet autumn clematis is invasive and should not be planted in Wisconsin.
Well, I have not heard that.
And I have not either.
I'm pretty sure that it is not on the invasive species list from the DNR. One of the vines that is on the invasive species list is the Oriental bittersweet. So mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a bit of confusion there. The bush honeysuckles are on the invasive species list, but not the vining honeysuckle. But as far as I know, it is not on the invasive species list.
There we go. Scott in Hartford, your turn. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Hey, we recently moved into a new home, and this is actually my first very nice yard. And so I have some questions about spring yard care as far as aerating, rolling the yard, when to fertilize, and which order to do which in.
Okay.
Well, congratulations on your new lawn. I hope you have fun with it. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great recommendations for establishing a lawn, maintaining a lawn, using low-input methods, using organic methods. We have a huge series of publications available at the Learning Store on lawn care that you might want to check out because there is a lot involved in it. And lawn care is one of those things that you can take to any level of difficulty you would like. I can tell you, though, that the rolling the lawn is not a current recommendation for any lawn. The only time rolling is recommended, and it's done with an empty roller, no weight in it at all, is after seeding. And so they use a very light roller after seeding to make sure that the seed and soil have a good contact. But other than that, it's not recommended because rolling the lawn tends to compact your soil. In a lot of areas around Wisconsin, compacted soil is one of the bigger problems with trying to grow a healthy lawn. So I don't recommend rolling. Now, core aeration is a process where plugs are actually removed from the lawn and spread onto your ground, and that's a really healthy thing to do, but it needs to be done at the right time of year, and the best time to do it is in the fall when the soil is warm and moist and the grass is actively growing. It can be done in the spring, but the grass is still not growing very vigorously. At least the root system is not, and it's not tillering and doing its little propagation thing in the spring because the soil temperatures are so cold. So aerating is something that's generally best done in the fall. And what that does is it helps to loosen up compacted soil, and then the little plugs that are removed and lay on top of the soil actually help even out the soil. If your soil is really lumpy, if your lawn is really lumpy, you can put down a fine layer of compost on your soil, about a half inch or so. You can overseed your lawn, which helps with a lot of bare spot issues. But a lot of this is written up in beautiful detail in these publications and give you lots of ideas. So for many people, it's just a matter of selecting how much time, you know, which processes you want to use, how much time you really want to spend on your lawn. But the key things to having a really healthy lawn are making sure that you're mowing high, that you're applying fertilizer at the right time of year, which is the best time for a fertilizer is actually in the fall also.
Yeah.
when the plant is more, that root system and the tillering activity are so strong.
But that high mowing height is...
High mowing height and a nice sharp blade.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of those things that you could be doing right now, is making sure that your lawnmower blade is really super sharp.
Yeah.
And most of the little shops will do that for you for a very nominal fee.
Yeah, there's shops like that in practically mm-hmm. every community.
Right.
Somebody's there to do
it. Yeah, and if you've got a nice mulching lawnmower, but... You know, even if you don't have a mulching lawnmower, if you mow high and you're cutting only a small amount off at a time, a mulching lawnmower is great. But leaving those little grass clippings on the lawn, and if you do that,
it's good fertilizer
throughout the year. That's exactly right. It actually eliminates the need for one of those fertilization times. So it's a huge benefit to your lawn. Adds organic matter back to the soil.
And high is like 4 inches or
three and a half to 4 inches.
Yeah,
as high as you can stand it.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't like that 4-inch look, and some of them will go down to 3, which is still okay. I think in the publication it actually goes down to as low as 2.5 inches.
Ooh, but, I wouldn't go that low.
But you really shouldn't go any lower than that.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And don't wait so long to mow that you're moving half of the blade. That's very stressful on the plant, and then you end up with a big mess on your yard.
So for Scott, who's kind of new here, to get to the Learning Store, you do that online.
Right. learningstore.uex.edu, and just look under the lawn tab, and you will see lots of publications on lawn care. Some of the newer ones were written by Doug Soldot, and they are on more of the low input and the organic kind of do-it-yourself lawn care methods that will help to maintain a very healthy lawn.
So learningstore.uex.edu.
Right.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're not online, you can always call your county extension office.
That's right.
Or stop by.
We don't maintain a stock of publications in our office anymore, but if you are not an online person and don't have a printer, your local extension office can help you with obtaining a print copy of any of those publications.
Yeah, there you go, Scott. Good luck with your new lawn. Appreciate the call. And Ann in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a couple of things. I brought in a New Guinean patient last fall. It's pretty big, and it has lost almost all its leaves except the ones closest to the plant light, but it never did stop blooming. It's bloomed beautifully all winter long. So I wondered if the leaves will come back when I put that back out in the spring. And then I have a hibiscus that has done really well, bloomed and kept all its leaves all winter, but it got a little bit tall and leggy, and I wonder when I can cut that down and put it back outside.
Well, let's start with the impatiens first. So the New Guinea impatiens is a kind of a tender plant, so you want to make sure that it's not super cold when you put it outside. To stimulate new growth, if it's going to work, and I've done this with impatiens with limited success because they tend to get kind of leggy and in the house. But when you put it outside, when it's nice and warm, you want to make sure that you're putting it in a protected location so it's not in full sun right away, because even though you've been providing artificial light for it, it won't even come close to comparing to what the natural sunlight is. Mm-hmm. So
right.
You need to make sure that you're not going to really overstress and scorch and kill the plant, from putting it outside. So put it in a protected location and try cutting it back, because that's what's going to stimulate your new growth and try to stimulate those new foliage. During that process, it's really important that that it's not exposed to that full sun, that you make sure that it stays moist but not overwatered. And then it may not, but it probably will show some signs of life, so you can kind of baby it along and see how it does. Or you can just go to your garden center and buy some new New Guinea impatiens to put out.
There you go.
Yeah, of course I can always do that.
Right.
It's kind of a challenge to see if
sure.
I can.
I know, and I do these things all the time. I bring in begonia. I've brought in all sorts of things, so just to see how they do. And sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. The hibiscus, though, is, that is pretty tried and true. So hibiscus are one of those plants that you can bring in, you can take out. They are pretty darn tough. And a lot of times when people give up on them and throw them away, because they drop their leaves, they're really not dead at all, and they will come back. They will respond very nicely to a pretty severe pruning. You can cut them back 50% or even more, and they will come back. Make sure that you are providing them with adequate moisture. And this is the time of year to start fertilizing them as well, to make sure that they've got the nutrients they need to actually branch out and produce those new branches. The more you cut it back, the more branches they will that will emerge. The more branches you have, the more flowers you will have. So make sure that you're fertilizing with a fertilizer that is listed for flowering plants so that you get the right balance between nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. If you go with one that's more nitrogen, you may get a lot of lush green growth, but you might inhibit your flower production. So hibiscus is one of those things that as soon as the temperatures are above freezing at night, you know, they're pretty tough. They can they can handle it. But you might want to make sure that you're not putting it out and the temperature drops down to 20 degrees or something like that. And then just keep an eye on it and make sure that you are watering it and and protecting its growth, and you'll be fine.
And thanks a lot for calling, Ann. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Patty Nagai, our guest, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. The number to call, and we have open lines, get you on real quick, at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post a question, and if you have got a photo, if you have a photo, we could post that as well. We'd certainly love to hear from you. There are lots of questions online as well. I probably should take a few of those. An email from Gail. I've recently read about transplanting native plant seedlings into open bottom pots and then set on a large open mesh tray so that they will be air pruned. With this method, they develop a fibrous root system instead of a taproot that grows and circles around the bottom of the pot. Would vegetable seedlings benefit from being transplanted into a bottomless pot?
That's a great question. And, you know, there's a lot of research being done on different types of pots and how it affects root growth. And for a lot of perennial plants as well as trees and shrubs, they're learning that if they plant in these sometimes biodegradable, but sometimes pots that just allow more air movement, that air pruning both on the bottom and the top can help the plant develop a much healthier root system in that confined soil mass that the pot contains. So with vegetable seedlings, a lot of them will grow very well in a biodegradable type of a pot, whether it's peat or compressed paper or core, you know, that there are so many rice hulls, straw. There are so many different biodegradable pots now that vegetable seedlings can be grown in. And with the really skinny, lightweight ones that are truly, by the time you're ready to put the plants in the ground, they are really falling apart with those kind of pots, you get a really healthy, fibrous root system. Some of our vegetable crops don't make any kind of taproot anyway, so I'm not sure if the bottomless pot is any better benefit than the biodegradable or even the handmade newspaper pots that you can make for vegetable seedlings. But anytime you have a pot that allows more air movement and encourages that side fibrous root growth, you're going to have a better root system. And anytime you can take the whole pot and put it in the ground and know that it's going to degrade, that for many things is a better situation than trying to depot something and then put it in the ground because you can, of course, damage the root systems that way.
Patty Nagai, our guest for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Lots of people online. Let's go to the phones and talk to Gail in Oconomowoc. Gail, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. I just happened to be running through and caught your show. And there is a weed that keeps, it's literally trying to take over the whole backyard. I don't know what it is or how to kill it off. It grows literally 15 feet tall, and it's the stalk, as it gets bigger, is almost bamboo-ish. You know, it's very kind of lightweight, and it's got a shallow root system. I mean, the only way I end up having to pull them out by hand.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Every year there is more and more and more, and it's driving me nuts.
Does it have kind of, you said it has kind of a cane stem, so
yeah,
it has, does it have like a, the knots on the cane like a bamboo, like a place where you can actually see it's jointed, like jointed?
And I think it does.
And when you cut it, is it hollow? Is it hollow stemmed?
Not totally hollow, but yes, kind of light.
Does it have a little bit of a reddish color to the?
I don't know.
Like the joints, where the joints are?
Oh, I don't see that in my mind's eye, closing it, pulling them out. I don't see that. I see just green, and it's got leaves on. But
does it flower?
Really, no. Mm-mm.
You've never seen any flowers on it?
I've never seen any flowers, but, you know, they will, like, where I don't have dogs anymore in my kennel, they will literally come up and be higher than the 12-foot kennel. So I know they grow, like I say, almost 15 feet.
Well, it sounds like...
They're just...
It could be Japanese knotweed, although usually you see flowers Japanese knotweed, and that's pretty tall for Japanese knotweed. Japanese knotweed is an invasive plant, and it is an introduced invasive plant. It likes moist areas, but I think we have found that it grows in a lot of areas very nicely and is very difficult to kill. We do have a fact sheet on Japanese knotweed that shows pictures of it in all of its stages of growth and glory that will also tell you some very specific methods for how to get rid of it, if that's what it is. There is also the possibility that it is a bamboo.
That's what I was thinking.
Because there are some bamboos that are not supposed to be hardy here, but are. We've seen some bamboo grow like crazy down in Racine that was not supposed to be hardy here. We've seen bamboos that were supposed to be clumping bamboos that actually run
unclumped,
and so it is possible that it's that. So what I need for you to do is bring in a sample to your local extension office or take some photos,
take a good photos,
and include both a big photo as well as some small photos showing the detail of the stem, because trying to figure out exactly what that plant is going to affect how we recommend that you control it. But chances are it's going to, based on what you've told me, it's going to take a multifaceted approach to kill that plant. So it's going to be a combination of cutting and using some sort of chemical control and doing this repeatedly over time.
Unfortunately. And so get a long picture to show the whole plant, and then zero in on the stalk, and then if you've got the leaf.
The leaf would be good to see as well, but sometimes just with a close-up of that
stalk.
Jointed area on the stalk,
we
might be able to tell from that exactly what it is. But
2 years ago, it was like I saw one or two of them, and they were almost, isn't this novel, and look how tall it grows. And now, like I see, it is literally takes over every spot in the yard, except where it's mowed. You know, constantly the regular grass
and then it sounds like it's running. It's a running plant and it will continue to do that unless you control it. And with most of those plants, to really control it requires a multifaceted approach.
Need to identify it.
I would not even begin to recommend any kind of chemical control on it without knowing exactly what it is.
Yeah. So get this. It sounds like you're not going to have any problem finding samples to take photos of.
I think that should probably be pretty simple.
So, good luck, Gail. Thank you so much for calling. Chris in Appleton, it is your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had a question. At the end of the mowing season, when all the leaves fall, I usually mulch them in with my mower really fine. I'll go over them like four or five times. And then I usually cut the grass really short. Is that a good thing to do?
Not cutting the grass short. Well, it depends. How short is short? how short are you cutting it?
Probably about maybe an inch and a half.
Mm.
That's borderline. So, you know, the recommendations for lawn care have changed significantly over the last few years. And that really short cut sometimes works out fine. Other times it is very detrimental. And so it depends on a lot of different factors. It depends on how sharp your blade is when you make that cut, what the temperature is, what the winter is like, what the spring is like. But we know that in some cases, when you cut your lawn really short, that you can introduce disease. You can have stress damage to the crowns of the plants. So in the spring, you know, you may have some damaged areas to your lawn, or you might have an influx of a disease that you didn't have before. And in some cases, it doesn't hurt it at all. It's really, some of it is beyond your control, but the general recommendation is that you not cut that short in the fall. Now, mulching leaves into the lawn is a fine practice. That works really well.
Mm-hmm.
It is just as good as using the mulching mower to replace those grass clippings into the lawn. So it's a source of organic matter. It's a source of fertility for the grass. And so mulching leaves into the lawn is a fine practice.
Yeah,
so
no problem.
Can you mulch in too many leaves?
Yes. No.
Okay. I get a lot of leaves.
Our former turf grass specialist, John Steyer, used to say that you could mulch up to 3 feet of leaves into the lawn over the fall. So,
because it usually goes over the top of my mower at some spots. So.
Yeah, and a lot of it will depend on how finely you're doing that chipping and mulching, over what period of time. I mean, I think if you were to run your mower over literally 3 feet of leaves at one time, that would probably be excessive. But he's talking about over the course of the fall season. You know, assuming that you're doing it over probably a month and a half period of time, because trees lose their leaves, of course, gradually. They don't, except for the ginkgo tree. They pretty much drop their leaves over a longer period of time than that. But he used to say that up to 3 feet won't hurt your lawn as long as you're chipping it in and doing a good job of that. The problem is if you're not chipping it well and you've got leaves, whole leaves, sitting on top of the grass, that is not healthy.
That's not good.
And that's true.
I mulch them down to like a quarter inch.
Yeah, that's great.
That's great.
And that if you're doing that, you know, pretty routinely over the course of the fall, those leaves also can substitute for a fertilization. So you're adding organic matter, but you're actually adding some fertility back to the soil as well. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yep. There you go.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks, Chris, for calling. Appreciate your call. Virgil in Cashton, your turn. Hi, Virgil.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've listened to your show for years. It's really entertaining.
Thank you.
And informative. I'd like to graft on a apple variety onto a different tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering which one of the joints is the best. I've done probably a dozen and got about two of them to work. And what I use is kind of a a wedge type approach. The one is, and then just try to hold it on and hit at least one of the sides of the cambium layer and hope for the best.
Right.
That's
sounds like
you're doing it the right way.
You're using a tried and true good technique. So some of your success is going to depend on the condition of the wood that you're grafting and what you're grafting onto. It's not entirely necessary, but a lot of people will have better success if the scion and the stock wood are the same size, so that you do get good alignment of the cambial tissue with the two pieces. Having a clean cut, making sure that you're using very clean grafting knives, is also very important to make sure that, and they need to be super sharp. So you need a clean cut that is very neat, and also, you know,
a little bleach on that.
Either bleach or some spray alcohol kind of disinfectant.
Oh, there you go. Okay, sure.
You know, make sure that your knives are super sharp and super clean. You can use, they make grafting clips, but they also make a waxy, stretchy material specifically for grafting that you can wrap around that joining area where you've put the two pieces together that helps maintain moisture.
I saw tape, electrical tape. I thought that'd be kind of hard to get off and kind of hard on the material. They said 3 years in some book, and it's like I lost my regular book that I go to, and I can't quite locate it yet.
Yeah, so they make a grafting material that is more of a waxy kind of thing that will electrical tape. I would think that would restrict the growth of the plant over time, and so I would go with something that's a little bit more flexible that will hold that moisture in. So they make specific tape for grafting. If you worked in a laboratory, there's a product called Parafilm Wax that it's a stretchy wax, and you can use things like that for grafting. And some people use beeswax. You know, there are lots of different things that you can use to cover up that and seal that wounded area to keep the moisture in. So that's really key too. The other thing that I know from my apple growing friends is the more you do, the better success you will have. So keep trying and just keep at it and do lots of grafts. And you might want to even look at doing some bud grafts in addition to the branch grafts, and maybe you'll have success with that too.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Virgil, thank you so much for joining us. Visiting today with Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and happy to have you listening into Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. We have a great group of horticulture educators for UW Extension. They work throughout the state, and many of them spend time with us on Garden Talk a few times a year. One of them, Patty Nagai. Patty's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County and has a wealth of information to share, and we're always happy to have her with us. And Patty, thank you again for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
I enjoy being here. It's always fun. I always learn new things from your listeners.
Yeah.
And I just enjoy answering questions to the best of my ability and getting some information out there. But I do learn things. It's always interesting.
Yeah.
The questions are phenomenal and they challenge me, which is good.
Get the old brain working, eh?
It's important at my age to keep my brain challenged. So yes, that's a good thing.
Oh man. Well, Colleen in Appleton has a question. Maybe she'll be challenging your brain. Let's find out. Hi, Colleen. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good afternoon. Yes, I have a question. Can we grow sweetgrass in Wisconsin? And if we can, where and how?
Okay, and you're in Appleton.
Sweetgrass.
Yes.
So are you talking about the grass that's used for basket weaving?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Sweetgrass, yes.
I'm not sure if it's hardy here or not. You're up in Appleton, so you're probably, what, zone 4?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. This is going to be one of those questions that I'm going to throw out to the other people who live up in the Appleton area to see. I don't know if it's hardy here or not.
I don't know. But stay listening, Colleen. We'll likely get a call in not too long from somebody saying whether or not they've had success in the Appleton area. So stay listening.
And then we'll probably find out that it's invasive.
Yeah, that's the next thing. But stay listening. We'll see what we can do.
Yes. We'll see what we can find out for you, Colleen. Thanks for the question.
Christine in Menominee, it's your turn. Hi, Christine.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We bought our house in Menominee in 2011, and we had a beautiful lawn when we moved in. Over the course of the last couple of years, we've had an increasingly difficult time with mold infesting our yard. We've tried everything from live traps to grub killer in the lawn. Nothing seems to work. Do you have any suggestions as to what could help get rid of these moles once and for all. My lawn looks terrible.
I'm sorry. Moles are, you know, they obviously like your yard. Mm-hmm. So are you positive it's a mole? You see the the humps in your grass, like big.
Yep.
Okay. And
we did catch one.
Oh, interesting. So what I was going to tell you is that from my discussions with David Drake about moles, you know, the question doesn't come up that frequently. But, of course, when it does come up, it's a very serious problem because they can mm-hmm. do so much damage.
Yes.
And they're often sneaky. You often don't see the live animal at
and
all.
And it doesn't take much to doesn't take many, I should say.
No, and that's the thing. You can have a yard that's completely decimated by just one breeding pair of moles. So they are very voracious eaters, and they are quite good at tunneling. And, of course, their main living quarters is not under those little shallow tunnels. It's deeper down in the soil. Mm-hmm. And so trying to catch them is it's a challenge. There are live traps, of course, as you know, that you can use. There are also the spear traps that you can set at the active tunnels that will... They're like harpoons that go down into the ground and kill them that way. And I believe that's what David has recommended on more than one occasion, is that mm-hmm. those tend to work better for taking care of the mole problem. They eat so many different things that just using chemicals to control the grubs is probably not going to be enough to discourage them. And we do have a publication on this, on how to get rid of moles, and it goes through the different types of trapping mechanisms that you can use. And I think that those traps I think you can rent them mm-hmm. as opposed to purchasing them. So you might want to check at your local hardware store and see if they have those harpoon style traps that you can use.
Okay.
Trying to discourage them and make them move away once they're located in your yard is very difficult.
They're very happy in my yard.
Yes, sounds like they are very happy in your yard, and that's a shame because I know that no one wants to kill these animals, but.
It's some people have had success with
repellents.
With a pail and a trap, a rat trap, or that's going to kill them. Where you put you have to have an active runway. Mm-hmm. You poke a hole in the runway. You put the trap down next to it, and you put bacon in it.
Oh, bacon!
And then you cover it with
apparently everybody likes bacon.
5 gallon pail or something large,
right.
And the smell apparently they like bacon.
Wow!
And they will.
Who doesn't?
One fellow trapped 9 of them out of his garden out of his yard with that
bacon.
System.
Wow!
So it's. You know,
some creative trapping ideas.
And you've got the pail, so Fluffy is the cat's not going to, probably get it.
Yeah, and that's another thing to be cautious about. And that's one of the reasons that, poisons aren't generally recommended because you don't know exactly what you're going to end up poisoning. And so that's a challenge as well. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of repellents that are out there on the market. And if you would like to try them, the secret to repellents is you keep changing them, and you you could spend a lot of money on repellents because they're very expensive.
Yeah.
And they don't last very long, and so they need to be refreshed on a regular basis, but they also need to be changed up because not all of them work the same way, and the animals get used to those various scents.
The goal
the
is
sonic,
to get them over. Yeah.
Those little sonic.
Those things don't.
Those
work.
Don't work. So, so.
Yeah, we tried those too.
Yeah, and you want to be helpful to your little natural friends and just ask them to leave and go away, but they're often very stubborn in
the
that way.
The goal is to get them to the neighbor's yard.
Yeah. Well, that's not nice either.
No, that's not
probably
nice
all they
either.
Wound up in mine.
yes, they were successful in encouraging them to go to your house. So.
Yeah, that could be. Well, there you go, Christine.
Good luck with that.
Right.
We do have a wildlife specialist with UW Extension that will tackle problems like this and will work with individuals, if they've really tried a lot of different methods and are not having a great deal of success. But you would need to go through your local county extension office.
Okay.
And they will help you even further if your current trapping methods are not working.
I don't have any moles, but I've been wishing almost I had one to try that bacon.
maybe you could go visit Kathleen and see, or Christine, and see if you can. Yeah, you could go to Christine's house and try your bacon method on her yard. I'm sure she would love to have you visit.
She'll let you know how it works.
All right. You call back and let me know. Thanks a lot for calling, Christine.
Thanks.
The old bacon method. Let's go to Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. I was just going to comment about Japanese knotwood, because it's been kind of half my life for about 15 years now.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear
that. We had maybe 75 feet of it on the back of the property.
Oh, my gosh. And how tall did it get in your yard?
Oh, maybe 10 feet.
Okay.
The last person thought it was a wonderful privacy barrier.
Oh, yes. Well,
so I was going to encourage people that you have to be persistent. I'm still fighting it.
Yeah.
So the first couple of years, we would dig these big clumps that may be 2 feet across. And, of course, it still comes up. And I also tried a year or two Roundup, which hurts it, I think. And then for a few years, I would just do a daily patrol, and any time I would see it, I would pull the stems off, because I heard that if you kill the green part, the roots die. And the last few years, I just take a walk through every couple of weeks, and still this stuff will come up. And if you turn your back long, it's 6 feet tall. So I go back with a shovel now. But I think if I turn my back for a year or so, I think it would all be back.
Right. And you know, there are... We have a lot of invasive plants in Wisconsin that can be, you know, just devastating on our natural environments and are very frustrating for people who are trying to control them. And that's, you know, that persistence is the key for all of them. I think Japanese knotweed and some of those bamboos are worse than most things, though, because they have such aggressive root systems. And they just, you know, they just are hard to kill. And even with chemical controls, they're hard to kill. So you are absolutely right, and I admire your persistence.
Have you tried the flamethrower yet?
And keeping on it.
You know, I think I even did that one.
Yeah. You can buy little flamethrowers.
Absolutely, and that requires some skill to use those correctly, but without burning down, you know, your house.
Or your toe or your, whatever.
Yeah.
Now my next battle is gout weed. Do you know that one?
Oh, yes.
It's all over the north side here of Madison. It's just awful. And I'm working on that.
What is it again?
Common name is goutweed, and it looks like snow in the mountain, but it has no variegation. And it's just all over here, and it's real tough. You know, I've tried smothering it and spraying it and just digging it, of course.
Yeah.
But I don't know what I'll do with myself if I ever conquer those, because they've been my life for 15 years or so.
Oh, Kathleen.
Well, good luck. Keep working on it, and... You know, with some of these invasive species, it helps if you have a planting plan for something else that can hold its own against your invasive species, but not become an invasive species on its own. And so, you know, in some natural areas, it really works well. Like if you're getting rid of garlic mustard, that during the process you start introducing some of the other native species that are suitable for that environment. But you, of course, don't want to introduce something that's going to take over and be worse than the garlic mustard or worse than the knotweed or the goutweed. But, yeah, it's a constant problem, and we have so many plants that are just horribly invasive.
Yeah. Thanks, Kathleen. Good luck. I want to give Sylvia in Appleton a chance because she's got possibly some help.
Oh, yes, about the sweetgrass. Yes.
Yeah. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. I want to commend that woman for her efforts to get rid of that Japanese knotweed.
Yeah.
It's a noble effort. It's a noble and worthwhile effort, yes.
Yes, it is just absolutely horrible. But anyway, the reason I called was to answer the question about the sweetgrass.
Mm-hmm.
I also live in Appleton, and I have a very nice patch of sweetgrass.
Excellent. I was just trying to look some stuff up about it, and it looks like it should grow here.
Oh, yeah.
What are your soil conditions like, and is it in full sun?
Not real good.
Oh, really? Okay.
It's growing right where there used to be an old stump.
Okay.
But it's growing around it. But I put in just a couple small plants, and it's spreading very nice. So
is it spreading in an invasive way?
No. Oh, good.
Okay.
No, okay.
Yeah. Yes. And do you make baskets? Are you actually using this for basket weaving?
No, I can't. My hands won't let me do that anymore.
Oh, sorry.
Well, maybe you could get together with Colleen and she could just come get your sweetgrass.
Oh, I like the smell of that when a little bit of it gets mowed. So.
That's great.
Okay.
That's
it's
great.
It's very nice fragrance in the yard compared to all these artificial ones from the...
Yeah, there you
That's
go.
That's good to know. Thanks so much for calling.
Thank you very much. And Al in Green Bay, you're next. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I had a question about a rose. I bought it Valentine's Day for my daughter. It was labeled a miniature rose bush.
Mm-hmm.
The blossoms are about the size of a quarter, and we've lost all of them, and it's growing a lot.
Okay.
I'm wondering if somehow I can transplant that and actually get to go outside for her during the summertime.
You know, most of those miniature roses are hardy here. So you might, if there's a tag on it and you can actually look at the cultivar and get a little bit more information about it, I would feel more comfortable with that. But most, you know, they are just little roses. And so there are a lot of people who grow miniature roses in Wisconsin gardens without too much difficulty. The question is whether or not it's the type of rose that needs some kind of winter protection or if it is truly hardy. And, you know, I think those are grafted. I don't think they're on their own root system, so that leads to another question about whether or not, you know, the winter protection needs to be just at the grafting point or if it needs to be, you know, over the whole plant. But miniature roses in general, miniature roses will grow outdoors just fine. You want to protect them from salt. So a lot of times people will like to put them right by a patio or a walkway, which is fine as long as you're not salting that area over the winter. You need to make sure that they are, you know, they're getting full sun so that they continue to flower and produce healthy vegetation. And of course, you know, you don't want to step on them, so don't put them in the path of your dogs or your children or yourself so that you don't step on them. But yes, they can be placed in gardens and grown. And just depending on what type of rose it is, other than being a miniature rose, may determine whether or not it needs that winter protection. But it will probably be much happier outdoors than it will in your house as a container plant.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, mm-hmm. Okay. One other thing, that lady was talking about moles.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've heard mice are allergic to pure peppermint extract. I was wondering if a mole would also have the same effect.
I'm not sure. I have heard that too, but I have not researched it to see whether or not that is a scientific mm-hmm. observation based on research or if it's just anecdotal. So a lot of the repellent type products, some of them are based on really hard science and some of them are based more on anecdotal evidence, which just, it could just be that they haven't been proven by science yet.
Yeah.
I've heard the whole thing about like chipmunks and spearmint gum and things like that.
Which that is not true.
Yes. So I don't know. And I have not seen any mole. And she was talking mole, M-O-L-E, not
right.
Vole, V-O-L-E. She was talking mole, which is the larger animal
yep.
that creates huge tunnels in people's yards. So it's a different species altogether. But I'm not sure. That would be something interesting to look into.
Yep. Thank you, Al, for calling. And we had a question from on our Facebook page from Jason, a good question. Well, they've all been good. Who says, I'm a second-season gardener, and last year I did not get the vegetables I hoped for. I had lots of big green leaves and very few flowers and fruit on my yellow squash and my zucchini. I also didn't get the green peppers and tomatoes to produce much either. And I'm wondering if I should have done something different other than water, fertilizing, and hoping for that. And there could be different reasons for the various things showing there.
You know, well, or it could be all the same.
Yeah.
You know, those are obviously, you know, different species of plants. But the thing that they have in common is that they like warmth, they like full sun,
yeah.
and they like good moisture. But in addition, he's mentioned that he's fertilizing and he's got big lush green growth. So perhaps he's fertilizing too much and maybe he needs to cut back on his nitrogen fertilization primarily. Because with a lot of those vegetable plants that we are looking for flowers and fruit, if you get that nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium balance off, you can end up with beautiful, lush green plants and very few flowers and fruit.
Yeah.
And so the fertility of the soil for a vegetable-producing garden is you know, a little bit different than some of our other garden types, and certainly different from our lawn. If you're not sure about what's going on with your soil, or if it's been a long time since you've tested your soil, it's not a bad idea to do a soil test.
Yep.
And just gather up a combined sample, send your soil sample into the UW Plant and Soil Analysis Lab, and get a general idea of what's going on there. You may find that your fertility levels are quite high, and maybe you can stop fertilizing this year in order to produce a healthy crop. But the other thing that can happen is if the vegetable garden is not in full sun, you also can get nice, lush green growth and very little fruit production.
Yeah.
So it's a couple of different possibilities there.
And if you get your green pepper in too early, the plants, and they get a little
they
cold.
They get chilled, yes.
Get
and
chilled,
that's true for the tomatoes as well.
Yep.
If they get chilled, you may not get good production. If you plant them too late, you may not get good production. So there's some timing issues in there as well.
And so we've got extension publications.
Right.
On a lot of
these types of things, selecting common crops. We have a new series of publications on community gardens that mm-hmm. cover a lot of these kinds of things. And they are geared towards starting and maintaining a healthy community garden. But many of the topics that are covered would also pertain to a home garden as well. So that's a good series of publications to look at to get answers to a lot of those questions.
Chris suggests using Tabasco sauce on bulbs to get rid of critters in gardens. Is it much cheaper and non-toxic?
Well, Tabasco, I think for the amount that you would need, Tabasco might be a little costly.
Yeah,
and there are other things in there, vinegar primarily, that might not be very helpful for your plant growth. So vinegar that acetic acid is a natural plant growth inhibitor, and it can burn the tissues. So, but the pepper is very valid and proven. There are many products that are available through your garden center that are already put together for you that mm-hmm. contain that capsaicin acid. Many of them are labeled organic. They are OMRI certified, and they do repel rabbits especially. So there's some evidence that they can repel other animals as well, but rabbits, yes. So capsaicin acid, yes. Tabasco sauce, probably not.
Yeah. And what about, we can still prune purple clematis vine now?
Depends on which cultivar it is. If it's a vine that normally blooms a little bit later in the spring, you know, clematis have a lot of different types, then they all are pruned a little bit differently. If you have pruned it in the spring
is a spring bloomer.
If it's a spring bloomer, you might not want to prune it. You might want to, you know, there are clematis that you're not supposed to prune at all. You know, if you have a late blooming or a fall blooming clematis, usually pruning it in the spring is a good thing. Some of them use more of a selective pruning. Some of them are only pruned every couple of years. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on what cultivar it is.
We are out of time.
No, not possible.
It's not. And here I was going to tell you about limey. Limey's got all kinds of flowers.
Oh,
getting
excellent.
Ready to start in on some new limes.
And those citrus trees are some that can, you know, those can be moved outside when the temperatures are above freezing at night also, and they will appreciate being outside.
Oh, yeah. Limey's going out as soon as possible. Patty, thank you so much.
You are welcome. I am always happy to be here, Larry. Great, great listeners today. Always great listeners.
Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County, and we'll definitely have her back. She'll be with us again. Just to let you know, Monday at 11, Mary Mellum is back with us to offer some great tips on your state and federal income tax returns. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.